Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Popcorn and Prosecco, our weekly movie podcast. As you may have noticed, we're down a co-host this week. Perry Nemiroff is off shooting Child Leader. And so tonight, it's just me and Angie Han.
Hello.
Well, actually, not entirely accurate. Later, we have a special guest. Jason Chait will be talking to us about his new movie, Putzel. But before we get to that, Angie and I are going to start our first review segment. We're going to talk about Under the Skin tonight and Only Lovers Left Alive. So, Angie, can you tell us about Angie, can you
that
tell us
so
about...
That was so embarrassing for you, Christy.
It was. I almost did that so smoothly. It was close. So close.
All right. Well, I will
tell
you...
Under the Skin.
I can tell you about Under the Skin. So Under the Skin is a new movie by Jonathan Glazer, and it's sort of a sci-fi horror thing, but really it's not like very many things you've seen before. Scarlett Johansson is the lead, and she plays... It's not really clear, but I guess she's supposed to be like an alien that's on Earth, you know, in the guise of Scarlett Johansson, and she drives around in like this white van picking up men for nefarious purposes, again, which the movie doesn't really make clear what she does with them, but, you know, suffice it to say that if you're a guy and you get in her van, you're never seen again. And, you know, so she's just driving around like Scotland picking up men, and I don't want to give away too much because it's a movie that develops in ways that I think that you wouldn't necessarily expect offhand. But, yeah, that's the basic premise. And then she kind of – it's just about her getting to know humanity a little bit. How's that?
I think you can say she's a predator. I feel like everybody knows that.
Oh, yeah. I thought that I was making that clear by saying that.
I just feel like we're going to get into a spoiler section on this movie because we want to talk about it. And it actually came out last week, but we had so much to talk about last week, so we're excited to get to talk about it now. But, yeah, I personally adored this movie, and it was – I wasn't sure what to expect because the people were talking about it in such grandiose terms. They're like, it's a modern masterpiece. Glazer's the new Kubrick and all that kind of stuff.
It is very Kubrickian.
It really is. And I don't mean that to say it seems like Glazer's ripping off Kubrick. It's just that it's hard to think of filmmakers who play with your mind the way Kubrick does. Like, I remember the first time I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey, like, in an actual theater. I was not on any drugs or alcohol, but I felt like I was, because by the end of it, like, my mind just felt like it was freaking out and melting. And then to, like, make everything crazier, the guy from the movie who played Dave came out and did a Q&A, but now he was old like he is in the end of the movie because it's many decades later. Oh, dude, like, I was losing my shit. I was sitting in the chair, and I'm, like, afraid to leave because it's my professor and I don't want to embarrass him, but I was just like, this is not okay.
Well, so that makes me wish that at the end of the Under the Skin screening, Scarlett Johansson had come out and tried to put me in a van and take me off for nefarious purposes. But that
did not happen. I still would have gone with her.
But no, it's. I mean, I hear exactly what you mean. It's the same kind of thing. It's an experience, which sounds, I think, really pretentious. But it is one of those movies where it's very unique. From the first moment, you see images that you're not really sure what they are, and so immediately you're just like, I don't know what this movie is doing with me. And it's really, I loved it. I loved just kind of like going in being like, I don't know what's going on, and just surrendering to the movie. It's the kind of movie that you really have to surrender to, I think, if you're going to enjoy. Like, if you ask too many like questions and get too nitpicky, then you're going to get caught up in all the wrong things.
Totally.
And Scarlett Johansson gives an incredible performance. I think that earlier on in her career, she kind of sometimes felt to me like a little bit blank. Here she is blank, but in a way where you can still see what's going on under the skin.
No, that's absolutely true. I was actually thinking, because I remember years ago, I saw her in The Other Boleyn Girl, which is a book I loved and a movie I hated. And part of the problem was that in the book, there's a lot of like interior monologue that they couldn't translate in the movie, so it's just like, let's look at Scarlett Johansson, think about things. And at the time, it didn't read, and it was really frustrating. But in this, she has dialogue, but honestly, most of the dialogue she has is completely unnecessary. It's almost just like prattle, because it's all part of luring in her prey. What she says is not terribly important. It's just, it's so much about...
She doesn't have any dialogue where she's like, I feel like this. Like, it's just kind of chatter.
Yeah,
she could be saying literally anything, yeah.
It's really incredible. And I mean, the movie actually literally starts with her saying nothing intelligible. It's like this, like, you've heard it, if you've seen the trailers, it's like, ba 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 ba, No, 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 no. It's like the movie refuses to let your brain lock in the first few minutes and be like, oh, this is what this movie is. And because of that, it kind of keeps you on your toes and it makes you uncomfortable. And the sound design is so extraordinary. Oh,
Yes. Oh
I
my God. I loved this movie. And one thing, you wrote an essay about this that I thought was really good, and one thing that you talked about was there's a scene where since she's a not a woman, but a person or a character that looks like a woman that preys on men, she's driving around, and there's this one scene where the camera just is like kind of like following these men around, kind of like if, you know, you're it's not like a POV movie, but it is the whole story is told from her perspective. And it's so interesting and so creepy to see the camera just like following men around, like all in a predatory manner, the way that usually in horror movies that usually happens with like, you know, the serial killer who's usually a man is like looking at women that way. And then when she goes to them, you know, the way she lures them in is also, I mean, you talked about this a little bit, but it's just it's okay. So basically, the way Scarlett Johansson lures these people in is she looks like Scarlett Johansson. So she pulls over, is like, "Oh, I'm lost. I need directions." And then these men just kind of are like, "Oh yeah, go there." And she's like, "Oh, do you want a ride?" And then since she looks like Scarlett Johansson, they say yes. And it was really weird to me because I was like, "There, no woman would ever just be like, let me get into the van in the middle of the night with a strange man." But
No
because
matter how nice he seemed, it's just too
no.
terrifying.
I mean, okay, well, let me rephrase that. I'm not saying women would never ever do that. I'm saying
Yeah.
all of them would know the risks when they were doing that. But all of the
Exactly.
men in this movie feel very secure. And one other interesting layer about it is that it's a lot of the men that she picks up in the movie are not actors. They actually had Scarlett Johansson, you know, with like a lot of the filming was covert, so they actually had Scarlett Johansson driving around the Scottish countryside picking up random men. And apparently none of them recognized her, despite the fact that this was like right after Avengers,
Which
that
is
she has
true,
like a
but if you
wig and
look at
stuff.
her with the wig and stuff, I can totally. I mean, why? And also, she has an accent, and also, why would Scarlett Johansson be
That's
picking up
true.
random men? Like, I can.
That's true.
I mean, I've actually spotted celebrities in places where I was told celebrities were going to be and not realized they were famous people until later. Like, I have a dumb story where I was staring at Bono from U2 for like 10 minutes because I was like, that guy looks like Bono but smaller. Like, it was Bono. I don't know why I. Whatever. It's so I can actually understand the men that were like, this one's pretty hot. I wonder if they thought like she looks a little like Scarlett Johansson, but like it's really fantastic. And
I
like
wonder if after they told the men that they were actually being shot for a movie and what the movie was about, if it made any of them think twice about like, oh, maybe I shouldn't actually just get into vans with strangers in the middle of the night.
I kind of hope so. I mean, that's actually I wrote a review slash essay for the Mary Sue about how I read this movie, which I read it as Jonathan Glazer making a comment on rape culture and kind of trying to make men understand what it feels like to be a woman in rape culture, not to make men understand that rape is bad, which like obviously rape is bad. It's more the idea of you know, these men don't feel threatened by her because why would they? She's a pretty lady. And like the movie uses that to kind of subvert and create a lot of terror, and I don't want to go into the full lengths of my article because one, you can read it at Mary Sue, and two, it goes into spoilers. But it's a really fascinating thing. But what I also liked about this movie is while I feel like that's what this movie is about, there's a lot of people who have written completely different things about what the movie's about because it's so willfully open to interpretation. That you can legitimately say, no, it's about this, no, it's about this. And I think that's part of why the critical community is really clinging to it, because it's one of those movies that it really messes with your head, it really draws you in, and then it gives you a lot to chew on, and it comes, you know, it's there's no answer. There's a lot of possibilities. And I think that makes this a really fun movie. And I think it's a movie that people are gonna like continue to find and continue to watch.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the other things that I thought found fascinating about this movie is that to us, this isn't really that unfamiliar of a world. It's just, you know, I haven't been to Scotland, but you know, it's people, it's
Sure.
villages, whatever. But the way that the movie is shot and the way everything, just the way everything kind of works together, you completely see this otherwise normal looking scene as like you see it from an alien's eyes. You see how weird it looks when you're not
Totally.
like a person who is used to this, which
And
is
not right away, because the first few
No.
scenes, these aliens, as we're calling them, it's kind of, I mean, it's again, it's never really explicitly said that they're aliens, but that's kind of the easiest way to explain them. You know, we're introduced to them in such a way that we stare at them as objects of terror. Like, wait, why is this going on? Why are they taking this body? What's going on? But as the movie unravels, like, you do begin to start empathizing with Scarlett Johansson's character, which is a really interesting thing, because you've just seen her do lots of terrible and malicious things. I mean,
yeah, you never feel like she's human, but you get to a point where you kind of understand her and you feel for her. Do you want to go into spoilers at all?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, we don't have much time, but we should we should talk about the ending and stuff a little bit.
What's fascinating is that the movie transitions from her being terrifying to her empathizing with her prey. And then
there's one guy in particular that she meets where I guess he has like what they call like the elephant man disease. He's, you know, his face is a little, like,
he's
weird.
He's very deformed. Like, he's so deformed that he shops in the middle of the night so people won't stare at him.
Right. And there's this, that's the first time in the movie that you kind of feel bad about what she's doing, because the guy is so, like, I think most viewers will immediately, I did at least, I immediately responded to the guy and you feel so bad for him. And then it's and it's so much so that even she feels like a twinge of guilt about what she's done to him. So instead of they don't really explain what happens to the guy, but instead of letting that happen to him, she lets him escape. And from there it becomes a story where she kind of starts to try to, I guess, almost to see what it's like to be human. You know, so she suddenly goes from being like this, like, you know, fearless predator to being not prey right away, but, you know, just like exactly what you would feel like if you were an alien dropped in the middle of an unfamiliar land and surrounded by things that you didn't understand. And
she tries to eat human food. She gets like a piece of chocolate cake and it looks so beautiful to us, and then she tries it and that doesn't work, and she meets a man who's nice to her, and instead of trying to lure him into her creepy web, she tries to form a bond and a connection with him. And it's a scene that's sad and really funny at the same time. And then ultimately the tables are turned and she becomes the subject of someone else's predatory gaze. And it's a very disturbing movie on a lot of fronts. It's funny because someone on Twitter said that they had to leave during that scene. And I was like, I don't know which one you mean, because there are so many scenes in this that are genuinely heart-wrenchingly upsetting. She meant, and I'm just going to say, the one on the beach, and when you watch the movie, you'll be like, I get having to walk away from this scene.
That's a really tough scene to watch.
But it's, you know, it's hard to watch because it is a movie that is made to make you feel uncomfortable, but, like, I like the occasional movie that really does my head in, you know? I think this is going to be on my top 10. I mean, I know it's really early to say that, but
it's definitely going to be on my top 10. I loved this movie.
I think you did, too.
Yeah, I think, like you said, it makes you feel really uncomfortable in a way that is really... but not in, like, a bad, like, oh, I don't like this kind of way. Like, in a way that's really exciting, that makes you remember, like, what cinema can do, which sounds really cheesy, but, you know, it's...
No, but, I mean, that's the thing. So many movies just want us to feel, like, excited or happy, and, like, this goes for a lot of darker sensations, and they were really felt by me. Like, I felt disturbed, and I felt upset, and I felt sick, and then at times I felt really elated and then didn't think I should necessarily. Like, I like that this movie, like you said, it's an experience, and I know that sounds like, you know... pretentious critic talk.
It's an experience. Yeah. No, but it's kind of like, it's not like Gravity, but it's like Gravity in that it's an experience to be taken in. I feel like this movie doesn't just show us something new, it makes you experience something completely different that is not part of your everyday life.
Absolutely.
So do you have any final thoughts on this?
No, I think we can move into our interview with Jason.
Okay,
and
great.
Here's how we're gonna do this, guys. A little bit of internet magic. Ready? One.
Oh yeah, two. I bet you guys didn't know. Christy's a wizard. Watch.
Yeah, deal with it. One, two, three.
And there we are.
Hey.
This is our special guest for tonight. This is Jason Chayat, director of Putzel. So, Jason, can you give us a rundown of the plot of Putzel?
Sure. Putzel is it's a bittersweet romantic comic fable. Which is like a sub genre that we sort of invented, and it's about a guy named Walter Himmelstein, who is a real Manhattanite, an Upper West Sider, and everybody calls him Putzel. His grandfather called him Putzel because he used to call his uncle Putz, so the uncle was Putz, he was Putzel, little Putz. Putzel is about a guy who's afraid to leave the small town that he grew up in, but the small town happens to be the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the plot deals with him and his pursuit of owning his family's smoked fish emporium, which we've named Himmelstein's House of Locks in the movie, And then his uncle has been married for a long time to Susie Essman, and he gets a little bored with Susie Essman. I don't know how that's possible, but he does. And he starts pursuing Melanie Lynskey's character, who's a dancer, a somewhat, I don't even want to say somewhat successful. She's not successful at all. A mildly still working dancer who comes in the shop one day, and the uncle falls for her, and then she and Walter fall for each other, and, you know, chaos ensues.
So can you talk to us a little bit about where did the idea for Puzzle came from? Because you're not listed as the screenwriter, but you helped develop the story with Rick Moore, who did write it.
I did, yeah. I mean, Rick and I had worked together on another project, and we were actually out pitching a more commercial project when we were trying to kick around new ideas that we could do together and hopefully make ourselves. And one day I realized that I hadn't left the Upper West Side of Manhattan in months because I was living there and working there and all of our friends were there and I'm very strange and neurotic and it was before our daughter was born and we weren't like schlepping her places. And when, as soon as I said that, Rick said, I think that's a movie. And I was like, okay, great. And then we spent a while trying to figure out what movie. And Rick is a really great writer and a real like craftsman in the classic sense in terms of screenwriting, at least in my opinion. And we spent a long time on it. We took it in a lot of strange directions. It ended up in a strange direction if you've seen the movie.
I was going to say.
We took it in even stranger directions. One of them was even like a Charlie Kaufman-esque riff on it, which I sketched out a treatment while I was on a lot of cold medication. And then I brought it to Rick, and Rick was like, no. Smartly. And then he had the really good idea, I thought, to put it in a very Upper West Side specific business, which is these appetizing shop, these smoked fish emporiums. Like the model for it was Barney Greengrass, but there's a lot of them. Murray Sturgeon Shop downtown. You have Russ and Daughters, and it's a very, they have them all over the world, but it's a very New York, particularly Upper West Side kind of business, which are these shops that specialize in things you put on a bagel, basically. And that's where we ended up setting it. And you know, the rest is whatever history was made.
Yeah, now that's around where I came into it, was you guys had a finished script, and
right.
You had asked, I'm assuming more than just me and my husband, to read it and kind of give you any kind of feedback we had, and
yeah.
I think primarily Zach and I were asked to let you know if there was anything in it that didn't make sense to us because we are Gentiles, because it is a very, very... culturally Jewish movie.
Right.
Which the only thing that threw me, I was like, I don't understand sawdust on the ground. You were like, that's an old shop thing. And then I was like, oh no. Did I tap out or am I still here?
I'm here.
Okay. Sorry. Something weird happened. Sorry, guys.
I see
again.
Everyone.
The joy of Google Chat. So anyway, so I was given the script after Zach read it, and he's like, I really like it. I think it's really funny. And I read it, and I basically said, I think it's great. I think the story really works. And none of the... It felt specific, but not alienating to me.
Right.
I think a good example is like My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where it's very specific to the culture of Greeks, but it related to a lot of people. And I thought, this sounds like a really great project, and I told you at the time, like, whatever you need me to do, let me know. And ultimately, I was a PA on the project for a couple of days.
Right.
Not my best work, but I was also the assistant editor on the film, which was a real honor.
Right.
It was a lot of fun to do.
That was some of your best work.
Oh, thank you. I worked really hard on this movie.
I know you did. You did a great job. We could not have done it without you.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, fawning aside, no, but can you tell us about, because you guys shot entirely in New York City and a lot of the times on location. Can you tell us about some of that?
Yeah, I mean, we shot entirely on location. There were no, you know, the movie... trying to think of what the budget was originally. We started out at like $1.6 million on paper, and which is probably, even then, was a little bit low for what we needed to do in terms of the ambition of the movie. Because it does, you know, a lot of people, and we've been at almost 50 festivals now around the world, and one of the things that people say all the time is, it looks like a real movie, which makes me sort of, it's sort of a compliment. It makes me kind of want to punch them.
I've been there for that a couple of times.
Right,
at the screenings
right. And I'm
I've
like,
been
it here. Is a real movie.
You handle it well, though. You're like, thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think what they mean is it's not just like, you know, I love movies. I love indies of all kinds. I love mumblecore. You know what I mean? I like movies where two people sit on a couch for 90 minutes and talk about interesting things. But we wanted to do something that was a little more classic and felt, you know, to use some of the audience members' words, like a real movie. Of course, for $1.6 million.
More accessible. I mean, well, it's a lot more accessible than Mumblecore.
And for $1.6 million, that's not that difficult to do. The problem is we just ran into financing issues, some of which because a lot of people thought the movie was too Jewish, which, funnily enough, in distribution we've become stuck between, like, it's too mainstream and it's not Jewish enough because it kind of plays to both audiences, which is a long story for another time. And we ended up making the movie for a little under $200,000. But if you see the movie, you're like, that does not look like a $200,000.
That's bonkers.
No, it doesn't, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how the casting came together? Because one of the, you know, obviously one of the things that really makes the movie work is that the characters are all really likable and relatable.
Yeah, sure. Great question. Thank you. The casting, some of the people in the movie, some of the supporting players I've known for a while. I've worked with before. Armando, the guy who plays Dr. Jake, is an old friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, one of the best actors in New York City. And I've done a lot of stuff with him, some theater, and I did a short with him in Puerto Rico. So we've worked together before. Adrian Martinez, who everybody knows his face, and he plays Hector in the movie, and he has a great bit in, actually a great supporting role in Walter Mitty, which he's very, very good in. I've known him sort of off and on in the off-Broadway theater scene in New York. And everybody else came through a pretty, pretty traditional casting process. There are some actors in the movie like Melanie and John who Rick and I are at the same agency as them. So we were able to sort of walk the script down the hall and be like, we have no shekels for you, but who do you think would like to do this and would be interested? And we were very lucky that a lot of people liked or loved the script and sort of we got along with them and it also provided them an opportunity, as they've said at a lot of talkbacks, like Melanie and Susie in particular, to do something that they don't usually get to do. This was Melanie's one of Melanie's first leads. Mm-hmm. She's done a number of them in indie films since then, but this was one of the first leads and she really loved doing that. She's incredible. And Susie, everybody, you know, Susie always jokes that everybody wants to hire her to say F you. I don't know what our language restrictions are here.
It's YouTube. Do your thing.
Okay. Susie always says, you know, everybody wants to pay her to say you fat fuck, but she wants to act a little bit sometimes, and she likes saying you fat fuck, but she also likes showing a different side of her, and there actually is a really maternal side to Susie, which is one of the things that drew her to this part. And she was a, you know, total dream to work with. The whole cast was great, and is great, and they're very supportive of the movie because they love it, and, you know, it's their weird little story, too.
Now, I remember you telling me that the character of Hector changed a great deal. That actually, didn't Adrian audition for Tunch?
Adrian auditioned for the crazy delivery guy and was great, but I'd really set my sights on a specific type for that for a number of reasons. And Fred Berman, who ended up playing the role, had played it, I think, since the first table read of the script, and he was great. And I love Adrian, and Adrian's the kind of guy that will make any role interesting. So we reconceived Hector a little bit. Rick had originally written him to be more of like a bodybuilder type rather than just kind of a big, tough, threatening guy. Mm-hmm. But Adrian was so great, we just said, would you be willing to play Hector? And he said he worked out his schedule. I think he was doing Piranha 3
Double D.
Whatever it was called at the time. And like we were trying to work out his schedule and he was like, I'll be back. And we were like, he's like, I'm getting away from the piranhas. And we were like, okay, so let's do it. And we were lucky that he was able to do the movie.
A different fish movie.
Yes, a different kind of fish. Equally disturbing in different ways, I suppose.
Well, I think that's pretty great. Angie, is there anything else you want to ask before we let Jason go and get back to work? We actually pulled him away from rehearsals.
Yes, sorry.
Are you working on a new movie?
I am working on a number of new movies. Right now I'm actually just rehearsing it. I teach at a drama school, and I'm just in rehearsal for something here for directing theater, which is another thing that I do.
He's a very busy guy. but Putzel is now out on iTunes.
Puzzle's on iTunes.
The iTunes charts.
It's on iTunes. We cracked the top 100 on iTunes, which is great for a little movie. And I think we nudged ahead of the Avengers, which was a real highlight. And we got ahead of The Notebook on the romance charts, which was, you know, my own personal victory because I've always wanted to crush The Notebook.
so this week you beat Ryan Gosling.
This week he beat The Avengers. That's the real story.
True.
Puzzle, bigger movie than The Avengers.
Yeah, well, you know, we're new. But it's a real battle. No, we're on iTunes and Amazon Instant Video, I think it's called, and then Google Play and Vudu and all those things in every English-speaking territory around the world. And you can also get the movie on DVD through Amazon exclusively.
We'll have a link below the video, so if you guys want to check out Putzel, great, and obviously we think you should, you can follow that link.
Thank you so much for dropping by.
You're our first guest on Popcorn and Prosecco.
I love the name of the show, by the way. It's a great name.
That was Angie's call.
My wife said the same thing. Good work, Angie.
Oh, thank you. Good work on your movie.
Thank you. Can I have some of the booze behind you?
Oh, yeah. I have some right here, too. See?
Not just set dressing.
Yes. I mean, I know you're in New York, so if you run over right now, you can have some.
It's true. Make it to Angie's house in about 10 minutes. All right. Thank you for being on the show, Jason. We'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye.
All right. So now that we've wrapped up talking about Putzel, we're going to move into our main review of the week, Only Lovers Left Alive, which is a movie I like so much I put on my top 10 list last year because it was open in Russia, guys, so whatever.
Yeah, I did too. and you know what? I'm not going to lie. It's probably going to be on my top 10 list again this year, even though that's cheating. Don't tell my editors. Don't tell me what to do.
That's my favorite. Anyway, so Only Lovers Left Alive. We'll get into the plot synopsis in case you haven't already heard about this movie, which you might not have. It's in limited release, but it's so good. So it's directed by Jim Jarmusch. It's his take on the vampire movie. And before you think, oh, I'm so over vampire movies, bear with us. It's Tom Hiddleston, Tilda Swinton, Mia Wasikowska, all playing vampires who live in Detroit. And Tilda and Tom are like, they've been married for like hundreds of years, and Tom's kind of world weary and not sure he wants to be around anymore.
He's basically like this like really angsty romantic poet type.
Yeah.
Like, you know, one of those like dark brooding artist types.
But the kind that you're attracted to, even though you're kind of like, you're a little too much. Like, it's just...
Yes.
But yeah, it's a fascinating movie. The plot of it is essentially like the two of them reconnect, and then Mia Wasikowska
is like the barest outline of a plot. Yeah,
yeah. It's been described as a hangout movie, and totally, it absolutely is. But like, it's what surprised me. We both saw this at New York Film Festival last year, and what surprised me about it was how funny this movie is.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, first of all, you hear vampires. You hear that one of them is super brooding. You hear that they've been alive for hundreds of years. You immediately have an idea of, like, oh, this is going to be very dark and angsty and, like, sad and passionate things are going to happen. But it's very, very funny. It's very, very heartfelt. It's very, very warm.
And
emotionally in a way that I don't think that you get from a lot of vampire movies or even just movies in general. What really is at the center of this movie is this centuries-old relationship between Tom Hiddleston's character, Adam, and Tilda Swinton's character, Eve. I don't think they're supposed to be literal Adam and Eve, but whatever.
Yeah, because you said they've only been together 300 years, so the math on that wouldn't work out.
So it's the long-term relationship between them, and I thought that it was going to be one of those relationships that's full of like passion and angst and drama because of vampires, but it's not. It really feels like what it would feel like if you spent 300 years with your, you know, husband or wife / best friend. It's such a warm, loving relationship. They're very, very different, but they've clearly gotten to this place where they kind of understand each other's quirks and, you know, wholeheartedly accept each other. They are a role model couple.
They're honestly really beautiful. It's very textured performances because, like, while he gets very dark and moody, her thing is to always, I don't want to say look on the bright side because that sounds so, like, vapid.
She's not, like, chipper, but she's very much more of, like, a, she's much more of an optimist, I guess,
than
he
is. She's kind of in love with the world in a way that's, like, very sensual instead of very, like, that's the best way I can describe
it. Yeah, she's not cheerful, but she's not unhappy. For example, there's, like, a moment where she gives him something, and he's like, what is this? And she's like, oh, it's O negative. And she's basically frozen the blood into a popsicle just because she was like, I don't know, fuck, I wanted to see what it was like. Let's try it. You know, so she's that
I
kind
love
of
her.
Person.
She's. I mean, it's like, it's. I remember when this first got, the cast first got announced, and I was like, oh, Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton as vampires? Yes, please. Like, it's so funny. I described it in one of my reviews, because I don't remember if it was the official review or the one I wrote at the end of the year of my top 10, but it felt like Jim Jarmusch had channeled, like, the weird dreams I was having at night. I'm not saying I specifically dreamed this. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying,
you,
like,
totally did dream about Tom Hiddleston after this movie, though, I bet.
We don't need to get into that. But
anyway, sorry, continue.
That's not unusual. But I mean, like, it's just, like, I was a kid that read Anne Rice books. I was a kid that loved vampires. Tilda Swinton I've been obsessed with since I was in college and saw Orlando. Tom Hiddleston I think is fantastic. It's like all these weird little things. It felt like this movie was made just for me. Like, Jim Jarmusch and I don't know each other, but he was like, here you go, Christy Puchko, for you. And, like, it's like magic when a movie makes you feel like that. When a movie director's, like, vision connects with your brain in such a way that you're just like, oh, well, thank you. You know,
I don't think I feel quite like it was made for me the way that you do, but I also loved it for it. You know, like I said, it's really warm. It's really funny. They play the fact that they've been alive for hundreds of years for laughs.
Yeah.
You know, not in like a broad,
I don't
like,
make it sound like way, exactly. But, it's not like Dracula Dead and Loving It. It is, no. Like, it's weird because if you watch, there's, like, a couple of trailers out, and the first trailer they released is very moody and very vampire and all that kind of stuff. But what's crazy is, like, it's a very funny movie. It's hard to explain the humor, but it's, like, Jim Jarmusch was totally aware of what vampire movies typically are, and he kind of decided to twist it slightly that, like, they know that they're kind of dramatic, and they kind of roll with it. Like, I mean, just Tilda, yes, Swinton's looks when Tom Hiddleston's character says some of the stuff he says, and it's just, it's a really beautiful movie, and the soundtrack's fantastic.
The soundtrack's fantastic. The production design is amazing, because you really, really do get the sense that they've just lived here for hundreds of years. A lot of it takes place in Detroit, which is kind of like run down, which, you know, connects to the movie really well, because one of the things that Tom Hiddleston's character is sad about is that he thinks humanity is going downhill, and he's sad about it. So they're just surrounded by all this, like, beautiful decay, which is a phrase that I hate, but which totally applies to the scenery in this movie.
It's lovely, because it's like there's so much richness in every aspect of this movie.
Every single detail feels like something that's been living and breathing.
Totally. Like, I mean, you know, the costumes feel really thought out. The costumes feel like they're from all over the place in a way that makes sense. I mean, everything in the film adds to the story behind this plot, this very simple but very beautiful plot. The performances are great. It's going to be stuff that people are going to be cosplaying for, like, years in, like, weird little corners. Like, goth kids are going to cling to this. But I think even just people who love, like, a good, rich romance are going to love this movie, because Hiddleston and Swinton are just so good together. They're fascinating to watch, and, like, the camera just, the cinematography in this is astounding, and the way it captures their bodies and sync together. I mean, it's just, it's a breathtaking movie. Like, I again, like, it was on my top, it was my number one movie last year, and I made it my number one movie because I couldn't wait to talk about it. Like, I was like, I know it doesn't open in the U.S. until 2014. I don't care. Like, I'm so excited it's out now. I think it's only out in L.A. and New York right now, or maybe some slightly bigger cities, but it's going to continue to roll out. So, like, if you can't see it this weekend, just hang in there. It's so fun, and it's so thoughtful, and I genuinely do think, and I'm a Jarmusch fan, I really enjoy his style of cinema, but I think this is his best film yet. I think it's just fantastic.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's just, it's so funny, because, like you said in the beginning, it's a hangout movie. Nothing, I mean, things happen, but not really. That's not really the point. It's basically just 2 hours of Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton kind of just, like, lounging around. But because
and it's hard to explain why that's so much fun to watch. Like, no, it's not just that I have crushes on both of them. It's just, it's so alive. Like, this movie breathes.
I think it's because there's so much thought put into every single detail of these characters and the world that they live in that, you know, you don't feel like you're just watching an actor kind of, like, lounging in bed. You feel like you're actually watching, you know, the way that, you feel like you're learning something about, like, the way that they live. You feel like you're there with them. Mm-hmm. Oh, and we haven't even talked about Mia Wasikowska and Anton Yelchin, who are kind of more, I guess they're slightly more comedic relief. Mia Wasikowska plays Tilda Swinton's little sister, who just, like, gets on Tom Hiddleston's nerves. I feel like if you watch the trailers, they make it sound like something horrible is, like, going on between them, and there's, like, all this drama that's going to happen. It's not really as much of a dramatic thing as a trailer is making. It's more like if you have like an annoying in-law, because that's essentially
who just doesn't understand boundaries.
Yeah.
It's
a really funny role for her too, because I feel like, you know, she plays a lot of like and spirited characters, but not like this, where she's like this like wild party girl that just has no regard for anyone. She's like kind of a ditz. It's so funny. And then Anton Yelchin
is the boy who the human boy.
Yeah, he's Tom Hiddleston's like kind of like human friend who like knows Tom. He knows how cool. He's kind of like us.
He doesn't know they're vampires.
He just knows they're incredibly cool, and he wants to hang out with them. And he tries so hard.
It's so cute. My favorite, I think that's one of my favorite scenes is actually, and it's in the trailer, and it's so perfect. The three vampires are sitting around at a bar, and they're all wearing sunglasses. And Anton Yelchin looks around and observes they're all wearing sunglasses, so he tries to very calmly pull a pair out and put them on and just be like them. And you're like, oh, like, it is trying so hard.
It's especially funny because if you watch the movie, Jarmusch, you know, he does a lot of the old, like, vampire tropes, like they drink blood and all that, but he also adds a lot of his own things to it. And one of the things is that his vampires do, like, I guess they have problems with bright lights, and that's the reason they're all wearing sunglasses. But Anton Yelchin just kind of looks around, and he's like, I'm going to be cool, too. I'm going to be like Tom Hiddleston.
It's exactly like, and that's what's so funny is, like, it's it feels like a really relatable movie, and not in these big moments. Like, I love vampire movies. I do. Twilight's not my deal, but whatever. But, like, I like a good moody vampire movie, but this movie is it's much more relatable. Like, it's not like, they're not you on your angstiest day. They're just you on a crappy Tuesday. And that's kind of what makes it so awesome.
They're just you. Like, Tilda Swinton has like a much more brighter outlook on life. And it's just, it feels like a real life, even though of course it's not, because we're talking about vampires that have been around for 300 years.
You know what it is? It's a slice of life movie about vampires, which is amazing.
Yes.
It's actually funny that we paired... So you and I decided this week that we wanted to talk about Under the Skin and Only Lovers Left Alive because they were movies that we both were excited about. That was kind of the extent of it. But if you think about it, what's funny is they're both genre movies that deal very lightly in their genre.
I was actually thinking about that too when we were plotting out our schedule for this week. It's like, oh, we're reviewing one sci-fi horror film and we're reviewing one like vampire romance. Neither of them are at all what you think they're going to be when you hear the descriptions sci-fi horror and vampire romance. And that's kind of what's so amazing about them.
Exactly. Like, they're both, they're definitely in those genres, but they do something with the genre expectation that's kind of magical and really wonderful. So, like, if you're lucky enough to have both of these movies playing this weekend, I don't know what to tell you. I would say see both of them eventually.
Cancel all your fucking plans. Who cares about your friends? They suck. Go watch these movies instead. Tom Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton will be your new friends. I'm so sorry. That's horrible. I'm a horrible person.
I gotta say, I think both of these would make for an interesting girls' night. Because, like, Under the Skin is disturbing, and you want to get cocktails afterwards and talk about it. And Only Lovers Left Alive is a swoon-worthy movie. Like,
not in the way where it's not like an Edward Bella so passionate kind of thing. It's more like if you've seen Friday Night Lights, like Coach Taylor and Tammy Taylor. It's that kind of romance where they just like love each other and get each other. It's weird, but they are the Coach and Tammy of the vampire universe, and that is like not a phrase I ever thought I would say.
No, it's amazing. I think we should just end on that because I can't beat that. So yeah.
All right.
There's a lot of movies coming out this weekend. There's Rio 2 and Draft Day and a bunch of other movies we don't even want to bother talking about. But I think our recommendations are, if you're not seeing Under the Skin or Only Lovers Left Alive, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. So on that note, I think on that very high note, I think we should wrap up for the week. So if you want to see more of what we're doing, you can find us on the web at popcornprosecco.com. You can find us on Twitter at popcornprosecco and subscribe to our YouTube channel, which, guess what? It's also Popcorn Prosecco. You can also follow us individually. I'm on Twitter at AJHAN. You can find my writing on Slash Film. And Christy, what about you?
I'm on Twitter at Christy Puchko, KRISTYPUCHKO. And you can follow all my stuff, because I freelance for a bunch of places like Cinema Blend and whatever, at decadentcriminals.com.
And Perry's not here this week, but since we also love her, we also think you should follow her. So you can find her at P. Nemiroff, and you can find her writing at littlemisscritical.com. And on that note, have a good night. Watch these movies. Seriously, you won't regret it. And make sure you watch Puzzle 2. Goodbye. Let's grab a napkin. Hold on. I love that he commented on, like, the same thing that you comment on every week, where he's just like, yeah, you know, there's, like, just, like, a giant stash of booze behind you.
Yeah.
We are called Popcorn and Prosecco.